Cambridge International Examinations. International General Certificate of Secondary Education. November Examination Series 2017. English as a Second Language. Extended Tier. Listening Comprehension. Welcome to the exam. In a moment, your teacher is going to give out the question papers. When you get your paper, fill in your name, centre number, and candidate number on the front page. Do not talk to anyone during the exam. If you would like the recording to be louder or quieter, tell your teacher now. The recording will not be stopped while you are doing the exam. Teacher, please give out the question papers. And when all the candidates are ready to start the test, please turn the recording back on. Now you're all ready, here is the exam. Questions 1 to 4. You will hear 4 short recordings. Answer each question on the line provided. Write no more than 3 words or a number for each detail. You will hear each recording twice. Question 1. A. Who will the students interview for the college magazine? B. Which picture do they decide to use on the front cover of the next magazine?
We need to talk about the next issue of the college magazine.
Oh, yes. We have to decide who to interview. How about the librarian? She said she wouldn't mind.
Don't you think the secretary would be better? We've already got an article about books.
I'd forgotten that. OK, I agree. And what about the photo for the front cover? What have we got to choose from?
I really like this one of the sports day, but we had something similar recently, I think. How about the one of the new science lab? It's different.
Yeah, but actually I prefer your first idea. It's a brilliant picture.
Great. We need to talk about the next issue of the college magazine.
Oh, yes. We have to decide who to interview. How about the librarian? She said she wouldn't mind.
Don't you think the secretary would be better? We've already got an article about books.
I'd forgotten that. OK, I agree. And what about the photo for the front cover? What have we got to choose from?
I really like this one of the sports day, but we had something similar recently, I think. How about the one of the new science lab? It's different.
Yeah, but actually I prefer your first idea. It's a brilliant picture.
Great.
Question 2. A. What time is the boy's appointment with the doctor? B. Which street is the doctor's surgery on?
Hello, Jack. It's Mum. I've just had a call from the doctor. Your appointment was supposed to be at 5:30 today, but they've had to change it. They've asked you to go at 4:45 instead. That means you won't have time to come home first. You'll have to go straight there from school. You can go by bus, get off on Black Horse Lane, and you'll see the doctor's surgery right opposite the bus stop, just before the turning onto Station Road. OK? Ring me if there's a problem, otherwise I'll see you later. Bye! Hello, Jack, it's Mum. I've just had a call from the doctor. Your appointment was supposed to be at 5:30 today, but they've had to change it. They've asked you to go at 4:45 instead. That means you won't have time to come home first. You'll have to go straight there from school. You can go by bus, get off on Black Horse Lane, and you'll see the doctor's surgery right opposite the bus stop, just before the turning onto Station Road. OK? Ring me if there's a problem, otherwise I'll see you later. Bye!
Question 3. A. What is the name of the company that won the new Business of the Year award? B. Where does the company director come from?
Later in the programme, we'll hear more about two local companies which started up recently and were put forward for the new Business of the Year award. One of them is a catering company called Wild Food, which received extremely positive comments from the judges, but was beaten by a car-sharing company called Spare Seat, which has proved to be a real success. We'll be talking to the director, Michael Onuma. Born in Brazil, he spent several years in Australia, where he got the idea for this company. We'll find out why he waited until this year to set up his business and about his plans for the future. Later in the programme, we'll hear more about two local companies which started up recently and were put forward for the new Business of the Year award. One of them is a catering company called Wild Food, which received extremely positive comments from the judges, but was beaten by a car-sharing company called Spare Seat, which has proved to be a real success. We'll be talking to the director, Michael Onuma. Born in Brazil, he spent several years in Australia, where he got the idea for this company. We'll find out why he waited until this year to set up his business and about his plans for the future.
Question 4. A. Which subject would the student like to study at university? B. What is the deadline for the student to complete his application form?
Hello, Mrs. West. I've got the brochures you lent me.
Thanks, Bernie. Have you made any decisions?
I wasn't sure about economics at first, though that's actually what I'd like to do a degree in now. I always thought I'd study law, like my mother did, but I've changed my mind.
Well, I suggest you talk to your parents about it, then we can meet in February to talk through the application process. You'll have to download the form and fill it in by April the 1st. You should hear back from the university by June at the latest, OK?
That's great. Thank you very much. Hello, Mrs. West. I've got the brochures you lent me.
Thanks, Bernie. Have you made any decisions?
I wasn't sure about economics at first, though that's actually what I'd like to do a degree in now. I always thought I'd study law, like my mother did, but I've changed my mind.
Well, I suggest you talk to your parents about it, then we can meet in February to talk through the application process. You'll have to download the form and fill it in by April the 1st. You should hear back from the university by June at the latest, OK?
That's great. Thank you very much.
That is the end of the 4 short recordings. In a moment, you will hear question 5. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 5. You will hear a student giving a talk to his class about names for the moon. Listen to the talk and complete the details below. Write 1 or 2 words or a number in each gap. You will hear the talk twice.
A few weeks ago, we all had to decide what to study for our projects on the origin of words and phrases. I was having difficulty making a decision. But walking home one night, I looked up and saw an enormous full moon. The answer was right in front of me. The next day, I started looking into various names and phrases related to the moon. I began with the term a blue moon. It's strange that we call it a blue moon, as we all know that the colour of the moon isn't actually blue. The definition is what causes some people to argue, although it's now widely accepted that if 2 full moons occur in the same calendar month, the second full moon is known as a blue moon. I read about this in a book called Stars and Planets. Apparently, it was first stated in an article by an amateur astronomer in the March 1946 issue of the publication Telescope Today. He explained that there are 29.5 days between each full moon. So if the first full moon occurs on the first or second day of a month, then there will be another full moon on the 30th or the 31st of the same month. There was a blue moon in July 2015, which I actually managed to see, and there will be another on the 31st of January 2018, so don't forget to look out for that. There are several common English idioms or phrases related to the moon. If you are over the moon, it means you are really happy. And if you promise someone the moon, it means that what you promise them is impossible. If something happens once in a blue moon, it means it is very rare. I can understand the meaning of two of these phrases, but the last one is misleading. This is because a blue moon is not actually rare. There are seven of them in every 19 years, which works out as one every 2.7 years. As I said earlier, a blue moon doesn't look blue. However, very occasionally, the moon does actually appear to be blue. This is when smoke or very fine dust rises into the atmosphere, for example, following a forest fire or a volcanic eruption. This is very unusual, but apparently, after the Indonesian volcano Krakatoa erupted in 1883, the moon had a slightly blue colour for 2 years. I also discovered that in the United States, there's a specific name for the full moon each month, and these names were given by Native Americans. The moons are named after several different things. For example, various creatures, such as Beaver Moon, and the first full moon in the year, which is Wolf Moon. Then there are moons named after things that they would have grown. So the full moons in May and June are called Flower Moon and Strawberry Moon, respectively. Before I continue, has anyone got any questions?
Now you will hear the talk again.
A few weeks ago, we all had to decide what to study for our projects on the origin of words and phrases. I was having difficulty making a decision, but walking home one night, I looked up and saw an enormous full moon. The answer was right in front of me. The next day, I started looking into various names and phrases related to the moon. I began with the term a blue moon. It's strange that we call it a blue moon, as we all know that the colour of the moon isn't actually blue. The definition is what causes some people to argue, although it's now widely accepted that if two full moons occur in the same calendar month, the second full moon is known as a blue moon. I read about this in a book called Stars and Planets. Apparently, it was first stated in an article by an amateur astronomer in the March 1946 issue of the publication Telescope Today. He explained that there are 29.5 days between each full moon, so if the first full moon occurs on the first or second day of a month, then there will be another full moon on the 30th or the 31st of the same month. There was a blue moon in July 2015, which I actually managed to see, and there will be another on the 31st of January 2018, so don't forget to look out for that. There are several common English idioms or phrases related to the moon. If you are over the moon, it means you are really happy. And if you promise someone the moon, it means that what you promise them is impossible. If something happens once in a blue moon, it means it is very rare. I can understand the meaning of two of these phrases, but the last one is misleading. This is because a blue moon is not actually rare. There are seven of them in every 19 years, which works out as one every 2.7 years. As I said earlier, a blue moon doesn't look blue. However, very occasionally, the moon does actually appear to be blue. This is when smoke or very fine dust rises into the atmosphere, for example, following a forest fire or a volcanic eruption. This is very unusual, but apparently, after the Indonesian volcano Krakatoa erupted in 1883, the moon had a slightly blue colour for 2 years. I also discovered that in the United States, there's a specific name for the full moon each month. and these names were given by Native Americans. The moons are named after several different things. For example, various creatures, such as Beaver Moon, and the first full moon in the year, which is Wolf Moon. Then there are moons named after things that they would have grown. So the full moons in May and June are called Flower Moon and Strawberry Moon, respectively. Before I continue, has anyone got any questions?
That is the end of the talk. In a moment you will hear question 6. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 6. You will hear 6 people talking about learning a new language. For each of speakers 1 to 6, choose from the list A to G which opinion each speaker expresses. Write the letter in the appropriate box. Use each letter only once. There is one extra letter which you do not need to use. You will hear the recordings twice. Speaker 1.
I've always wanted to learn Spanish. A few years ago I found a website which was useful, but I only learnt so much from it. There were other programs that people recommended at the time, but you had to pay for them. I'm not sure why I didn't want to do that. Anyway, recently I've started going to lessons each Thursday evening at my local college. The tutor seems really experienced, and as a group we all get on very well. I think I'm going to learn far more this way.
Speaker 2. As far as I'm concerned, speaking to local people is the best way. If you go somewhere and you're surrounded by people who don't speak your language, you need to be able to communicate, so you learn lots in a short space of time, because you have to. I've met people who think they can learn a language by themselves, sitting at home with a book or learning online, but none of them seem to make as much progress or keep it up for very long. Speaker 3.
I think having lessons is the best way to learn. I'm studying Japanese, and if I could, I'd join a full-time course for a few months so I'd make faster progress. For now, though, I'm having lessons twice a week, and then some of us get together once a week for a conversation evening. We try to use the language we've been taught, and every now and then we also get a native Japanese speaker to come along too. And I think that helps, even though we're not very good.
Speaker 4.
I'm learning Italian. I've got a really good book, so I study at home in the evenings and at weekends. I don't have any problem getting on with it. I don't understand it when some people say that they need a reason to study and can't keep it up on their own. What I do notice is that I'm quite confident with reading, writing and grammar, but I'm not convinced that my pronunciation is right. So I'm going to find an Italian person to practice with.
Speaker 5.
I've tried learning various languages over the years, some with more success than others. I'd suggest starting out in a class, though you'll probably only be able to afford to pay for a part-time course. So the solution is to set aside a small amount of time each day to practice as much as you can at home. And this is vital, because the success of a class very much depends on the enthusiasm of the other learners and how well you get on with the teacher.
Speaker 6.
I'm trying to learn Russian at the moment. People tell me that I should go and spend a couple of months living with a Russian family, but I can't take that much time off work and I couldn't afford it either, so I'm not convinced that's the best advice. Actually, I've discovered plenty of programs on the web and I've registered with a couple of them, which I'm finding really useful. And there's no fee for them either, which is amazing.
Now you will hear the six speakers again. Speaker 1.
I've always wanted to learn Spanish. A few years ago I found a website which was useful, but I only learnt so much from it. There were other programs that people recommended at the time, but you had to pay for them. I'm not sure why I didn't want to do that. Anyway, recently I've started going to lessons each Thursday evening at my local college. The tutor seems really experienced, and as a group we all get on very well. I think I'm going to learn far more this way.
Speaker 2. As far as I'm concerned, speaking to local people is the best way. If you go somewhere and you're surrounded by people who don't speak your language, you need to be able to communicate. So you learn lots in a short space of time, because you have to. I've met people who think they can learn a language by themselves, sitting at home with a book or learning online, but none of them seem to make as much progress or keep it up for very long. Speaker 3.
I think having lessons is the best way to learn. I'm studying Japanese, and if I could, I'd join a full-time course for a few months so I'd make faster progress. For now, though, I'm having lessons twice a week, and then some of us get together once a week for a conversation evening. We try to use the language we've been taught, and every now and then we also get a native Japanese speaker to come along too. And I think that helps, even though we're not very good.
Speaker 4.
I'm learning Italian. I've got a really good book, so I study at home in the evenings and at weekends. I don't have any problem getting on with it. I don't understand it when some people say that they need a reason to study and can't keep it up on their own. What I do notice is that I'm quite confident with reading, writing and grammar, but I'm not convinced that my pronunciation is right. So I'm going to find an Italian person to practice with.
Speaker 5.
I've tried learning various languages over the years, some with more success than others. I'd suggest starting out in a class, though you'll probably only be able to afford to pay for a part-time course. So the solution is to set aside a small amount of time each day to practice as much as you can at home. And this is vital, because the success of a class very much depends on the enthusiasm of the other learners and how well you get on with the teacher.
Speaker 6.
I'm trying to learn Russian at the moment. People tell me that I should go and spend a couple of months living with a Russian family, but I can't take that much time off work and I couldn't afford it either, so I'm not convinced that's the best advice. Actually, I've discovered plenty of programs on the web and I've registered with a couple of them, which I'm finding really useful. And there's no fee for them either, which is amazing.
That is the end of question 6. In a moment, you will hear question 7. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 7. You will hear a teacher talking to a professional musician called Thomas Linder about his work. Listen to the interview and look at the questions. For each question, choose the correct answer, A, B, or C, and put a tick in the appropriate box. You will hear the interview twice.
Thomas Linder, thank you for coming here today. How does it feel to be back at your old school?
It's good. I enjoyed my time here.
We've all been looking forward to your visit, and the students have prepared several questions for you. Let me start by asking when you realised you wanted to be a professional musician.
Well, I remember one particular concert that inspired me to take up the cello, but I'd already made up my mind by then. I'd been given a classical music CD, and I just thought, this is it. It's what I want to do. Then I came first in a music competition soon after, which made me much more confident about my decision.
Was cello the first instrument you learned to play?
No, I had piano lessons before taking up the cello, and still play it now, though not professionally. Before that, I was desperate to play the guitar, but my parents persuaded me to start with a violin instead.
Some of the students here want to study music at university, like you. What was that like?
I got accepted onto a music and philosophy course. It was really interesting, but I found it hard in the first term and ended up switching to music performance. Looking back, I shouldn't have done that. I'd have liked to learn more about music theory, but at least I can say that I don't think I could have worked any harder than I did.
Several students want to know what sort of work you enjoy most of all as a professional.
Well, I don't have one full-time job. I do many different things. I'm sometimes asked to do a studio session, which might be for a TV soundtrack, an advert, or a CD. That's always fun. And I play regularly with an orchestra. The other musicians feel like my second family now, and that's something I'd find hardest to give up. And I compose a bit. That's quite exciting too.
Is it difficult not having one regular job?
I don't mind that. I like the variety. Of course, I earn less if I don't get much work, but that's not such a problem. What I find most demanding is that I get tired when I'm touring with the orchestra. It's partly having to move from place to place every few days, but more the fact that we work late and I often don't get to sleep until 2 or 3 in the morning.
What would you say to students who are thinking of a career in music?
Of course, you need to be technically excellent at your chosen instrument. But that comes from constantly learning, focusing on improving, doing exercises. It's making the effort to keep doing that, day in, day out, which is essential. Without that, you won't succeed. You also need to be able to stand up in front of an audience, but that gets easier the more you do it.
How do you learn a piece of music that you've never played before?
That's an interesting question. Different musicians have different techniques. Some like to hear it before playing it, but I prefer to interpret the music my own way instead. At college, I was taught to spend time studying the way the music was written before picking up my cello, and I hated that. I just wanted to start playing. But I've realised the point of it now. It's what I always try to do if I can.
One last question, Thomas. What are your plans for the future?
Well, I've got several. I'm going to be tutoring 9- and 10-year-olds in a school orchestra, which I'm excited about. And I've been asked by a publisher to write about the history of my instrument. That might be next year. Just for fun, though, I'm going to have a go at playing the trumpet. I've got a lesson straight after this, in fact.
Well, good luck with that, Thomas.
Thank you.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Thomas Linder, thank you for coming here today. How does it feel to be back at your old school?
It's good. I enjoyed my time here.
We've all been looking forward to your visit, and the students have prepared several questions for you. Let me start by asking when you realised you wanted to be a professional musician.
Well, I remember one particular concert that inspired me to take up the cello, but I'd already made up my mind by then. I'd been given a classical music CD, and I just thought, this is it. It's what I want to do. Then I came first in a music competition soon after, which made me much more confident about my decision.
Was cello the first instrument you learned to play?
No, I had piano lessons before taking up the cello, and still play it now, though not professionally. Before that, I was desperate to play the guitar, but my parents persuaded me to start with a violin instead.
Some of the students here want to study music at university, like you. What was that like?
I got accepted onto a music and philosophy course. It was really interesting, but I found it hard in the first term and ended up switching to music performance. Looking back, I shouldn't have done that. I'd have liked to learn more about music theory, but at least I can say that I don't think I could have worked any harder than I did.
Several students want to know what sort of work you enjoy most of all as a professional.
Well, I don't have one full-time job. I do many different things. I'm sometimes asked to do a studio session, which might be for a TV soundtrack, an advert, or a CD. That's always fun. And I play regularly with an orchestra. The other musicians feel like my second family now, and that's something I'd find hardest to give up. And I compose a bit. That's quite exciting too.
Is it difficult not having one regular job?
I don't mind that. I like the variety. Of course, I earn less if I don't get much work, but that's not such a problem. What I find most demanding is that I get tired when I'm touring with the orchestra. It's partly having to move from place to place every few days, but more the fact that we work late and I often don't get to sleep until 2 or 3 in the morning.
What would you say to students who are thinking of a career in music?
Of course, you need to be technically excellent at your chosen instrument. But that comes from constantly learning, focusing on improving, doing exercises. It's making the effort to keep doing that, day in, day out, which is essential. Without that, you won't succeed. You also need to be able to stand up in front of an audience, but that gets easier the more you do it.
How do you learn a piece of music that you've never played before?
That's an interesting question. Different musicians have different techniques. Some like to hear it before playing it, but I prefer to interpret the music my own way instead. At college, I was taught to spend time studying the way the music was written before picking up my cello, and I hated that. I just wanted to start playing. But I've realised the point of it now. It's what I always try to do if I can.
One last question, Thomas. What are your plans for the future?
Well, I've got several. I'm going to be tutoring 9- and 10-year-olds in a school orchestra, which I'm excited about. And I've been asked by a publisher to write about the history of my instrument. That might be next year. Just for fun, though, I'm going to have a go at playing the trumpet. I've got a lesson straight after this, in fact.
Well, good luck with that, Thomas.
Thank you.
That is the end of question 7. In a moment, you will hear question 8. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 8. Part A. You will hear a biologist giving a talk about the problems caused by people gathering wild mushrooms. Listen to the talk and complete the sentences in Part A. Write one or two words only in each gap. You will hear the talk twice.
As you know, one of my areas of interest is fungi, or mushrooms. I recently spent some time researching rare species in the New Forest, England, which is one of the best places to find fungi in Europe, perhaps even the world. However, while working there, I became aware of problems caused by people picking mushrooms irresponsibly. Mushroom gathering has long been popular around the world, particularly in Europe, Australia, Asia, and North America. Generally, people gather small amounts of mushrooms for domestic use. However, in some areas, it's done on what's recognised as an industrial scale, which is inevitably creating many problems for the habitat. It is becoming more and more common for people to try to make a living from selling mushrooms, for example, to restaurants and markets, with the result that some areas of forest and woodland are being stripped by gangs of determined pickers. This destruction is causing great concern to conservation groups in particular, and there are some people who believe that protection of certain forest areas is now a necessity. Pickers have been known to gather everything they come across, then sort out what they can sell later. This means that the majority of what they pick is later thrown away, as many species are not edible. It also means that some species may not survive, and that there are fewer wild fungi for members of the public to enjoy looking at when they are out in the countryside. The variety of wild fungi is spectacular. Their strange shapes and colours make them look like objects from outer space, rather than simple plants on the forest floor. Many look very different from the classic umbrella-shaped mushrooms that we see in the supermarket. Some have interesting names as well. Of course, as a scientist, I refer to species by their Latin or scientific names, but many popular edible mushrooms have common names too, which often relate to their characteristics. Examples include the honey mushroom, because of its colour, the pine mushroom, as it usually grows beneath trees of that name, and the butter mushroom, as it seems to have an oily layer on its surface. The New Forest, where I've been studying fungi, has many ancient trees. These trees, and the mushrooms that grow on or around them, have a special two-way relationship with each other. Mushrooms can protect the roots of the trees and also supply them with minerals, while the trees produce sugars which the mushrooms need to survive. If the fungi are removed in large quantities, then potentially the trees will end up suffering. As yet, we do not know what effect this will have in the long term.
Now you will hear the talk again.
As you know, one of my areas of interest is fungi, or mushrooms. I recently spent some time researching rare species in the New Forest, England, which is one of the best places to find fungi in Europe, perhaps even the world. However, while working there, I became aware of problems caused by people picking mushrooms irresponsibly. Mushroom gathering has long been popular around the world, particularly in Europe, Australia, Asia, and North America. Generally, people gather small amounts of mushrooms for domestic use. However, in some areas, it's done on what's recognised as an industrial scale, which is inevitably creating many problems for the habitat. It is becoming more and more common for people to try to make a living from selling mushrooms, for example, to restaurants and markets, with the result that some areas of forest and woodland are being stripped by gangs of determined pickers. This destruction is causing great concern to conservation groups in particular, and there are some people who believe that protection of certain forest areas is now a necessity. Pickers have been known to gather everything they come across, then sort out what they can sell later. This means that the majority of what they pick is later thrown away, as many species are not edible. It also means that some species may not survive, and that there are fewer wild fungi for members of the public to enjoy looking at when they are out in the countryside. The variety of wild fungi is spectacular. Their strange shapes and colours make them look like objects from outer space, rather than simple plants on the forest floor. Many look very different from the classic umbrella-shaped mushrooms that we see in the supermarket. Some have interesting names as well. Of course, as a scientist, I refer to species by their Latin or scientific names, but many popular edible mushrooms have common names too, which often relate to their characteristics. Examples include the honey mushroom, because of its colour, the pine mushroom, as it usually grows beneath trees of that name, and the butter mushroom, as it seems to have an oily layer on its surface. The New Forest, where I've been studying fungi, has many ancient trees. These trees, and the mushrooms that grow on or around them, have a special two-way relationship with each other. Mushrooms can protect the roots of the trees and also supply them with minerals, while the trees produce sugars which the mushrooms need to survive. If the fungi are removed in large quantities, then potentially the trees will end up suffering. As yet, we do not know what effect this will have in the long term.
Question 8. Part B. Now listen to a conversation between two students about wild mushrooms and complete the sentences in Part B. Write one or two words only in each gap. You will hear the conversation twice.
Do you remember those fungi we saw on our biology field trip last month?
Yes, they were amazing, weren't they? All sorts of shapes and colours. I took some pictures on my phone and I've identified a few. I'd love to know which ones are edible.
Me too.
I like the fact that lots of fungi are named because of their shape or because they look like something. There are some which hang down from tree branches, so they're called tooth fungi. I think they're quite rare though, and I'm sure we didn't spot one. We did see a type of bracket mushroom though. Here, I've got a picture. It's as if it's a shelf sticking out from the tree trunk.
Oh, yes. There are many types of bracket mushroom. One's called the beefsteak. I read about it, and I'm pretty sure you can eat it. Apparently, one way of identifying mushrooms is to see if they release any liquid, either when you cut them or just as they grow. It might look like ink, for example, or milk, but this one sometimes drips juice that resembles blood. People have mistaken them for parts of a human body before.
Oh. So, would you eat one if you saw it?
Well, if I was sure it was the right species. Apparently, the flavour is very distinctive. It's supposed to be amazing. You can use smell to identify other types of mushroom as well. It can be very noticeable. I read there's one variety which smells strongly of apples. Another even smells of crab.
I don't think I'd be confident enough to eat a mushroom from the wild, unless I was with an expert. It's too risky. And it's not only the fact that some are toxic, others absorb large quantities of radiation from the air around them because they lack roots. I've heard you should avoid picking mushrooms in areas affected by pollution too.
So what about going on a course to learn more about identifying mushrooms?
I'd love to.
Well, there's a couple I found out about. One called Eating Nature, and that focuses on species which are edible. You even get to cook some on a fire. And there's another called Hidden Secrets, which teaches you ways to identify species using a field guide. I quite like the sound of the first one.
Although the other one might be more useful for our studies.
And it's running next weekend. Okay, shall I book places for us?
Great.
Now you will hear the conversation again.
Do you remember those fungi we saw on our biology field trip last month?
Yes, they were amazing, weren't they? All sorts of shapes and colours. I took some pictures on my phone and I've identified a few. I'd love to know which ones are edible.
Me too.
I like the fact that lots of fungi are named because of their shape or because they look like something. There are some which hang down from tree branches, so they're called tooth fungi. I think they're quite rare, though, and I'm sure we didn't spot one. We did see a type of bracket mushroom, though. Here, I've got a picture. It's as if it's a shelf sticking out from the tree trunk.
Oh, yes. There are many types of bracket mushroom. One's called the beefsteak. I read about it, and I'm pretty sure you can eat it. Apparently, one way of identifying mushrooms is to see if they release any liquid, either when you cut them or just as they grow. It might look like ink, for example, or milk, but this one sometimes drips juice that resembles blood. People have mistaken them for parts of a human body before.
Oh, so would you eat one if you saw it?
Well, if I was sure it was the right species. Apparently, the flavour is very distinctive. It's supposed to be amazing. You can use smell to identify other types of mushroom as well. It can be very noticeable. I read there's one variety which smells strongly of apples. Another even smells of crab.
I don't think I'd be confident enough to eat a mushroom from the wild, unless I was with an expert. It's too risky. And it's not only the fact that some are toxic, others absorb large quantities of radiation from the air around them because they lack roots. I've heard you should avoid picking mushrooms in areas affected by pollution too.
So what about going on a course to learn more about identifying mushrooms?
I'd love to.
Well, there's a couple I found out about. One called Eating Nature, and that focuses on species which are edible. You even get to cook some on a fire. And there's another called Hidden Secrets, which teaches you ways to identify species using a field guide. I quite like the sound of the first one.
Although the other one might be more useful for our studies.
And it's running next weekend. OK, shall I book places for us?
Great.
That is the end of question 8 and of the exam. In a moment, your teacher will collect your papers. Please check that you have written your name, centre number and candidate number on the front of your question paper. Remember, you must not talk until all the papers have been collected. Teacher, please collect all the papers.